Yeah, good. Lovely stuff. So yeah, I'm Paul, for anyone who doesn't know me. I'm one of the elders here at Jubilee Church and part of the team that leads this site as well. And so yeah, I'm going to continue our series on Hebrews today. As Rosie said, bit of a tricky passage, but we'll get to that in a moment. Do you ever have times with someone that you know, maybe someone that you know really well, and they surprise you with something that they do or something that they say, and you're left shocked for a moment thinking, wow, there's more to that person than I realise. There's deeper depth, there's more complexity to that person than I give them credit for. Our daughter, Rebecca, is at the age where she's giving us quite a lot of these moments currently. She's 4, where she's kind of growing and learning every day. Her character is developing in front of us. So last week, I cycled home from St. Columbus in a torrential downpour. It's about a 20-minute cycle, so I was dripping head to toe. The padding in my bike helmet took 2 days to dry. I was very, very wet. And so I got home, I opened the front door, and Rebecca popped her head out into the hallway and looked at me, and I was going, oh, I'm so wet. Becca, I'm dripping. Look at me, I'm soaked. And Becca is 4. She had been in St. Columbus that day, as it happened, and then got driven home. And so she looked at me and she went, what? It's only 5 minutes home. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, actually, it's a little bit longer than that, Rebecca, when you're on a bike. And she shrugged and she went, 6 then, and walked off. And I found that amusing because in that moment, it was less like talking to my 4-year-old daughter and more like being put in your place by a sarcastic aunt or something. And that is just a silly example, but as I say, we are often having these moments with Rebecca at the moment where we kind of, she does something or says something and we're like, whoa, there's more going on in your little 4-year-old brain than we realise, than we give you credit for sometimes. Do you ever have those moments? I'm sure that you do, because the truth is we're all deeper and more complex than we even realise about ourselves often. And so there's always more of us for others around us to learn, even people very close to us. Well, if that is true for us, that we are deeper and more complex than we even realise about ourselves sometimes, then I think it's probably fair to assume that that is infinitely more true of God. So the passage that we are going to look at today, I think, has the potential to give us one of those moments where we're confronted with the character of God and all we're left to be able to say is, whoa, you are deeper and more complex than I perhaps give you credit for. Before we read the passage, just want to remind us why we're doing this series at all. Why is it that we're preaching through the book of Hebrews? That's next week. Hebrews 11. Hebrews, and that is because at a Catalyst conference, Catalyst is the group of churches, family of churches that we're a part of, at a conference like last year, I think, or maybe the year before, someone brought a prophetic word they felt from God based on Psalm 25, verse 14, which says, the friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes known to them his covenant. And then the person said, the current generation, us, needs to learn the fear of the Lord, holy reverence. Then he will call us friends. I'm up for that. This sort of reverence, they said, leads to obedience and his manifest presence. Okay, so that was this word that was brought a little while ago now, and that resonated with a lot of people. And so from that, we decided, yeah, let's preach through Hebrews. And so that's underpinning this whole series, right? Okay, so we'll read this passage, but actually I'm going to start by reading last week's passage first, because it's important when we're reading the Bible, when we're preaching the Bible, not to take verses out of their context, okay? Because otherwise, what we end up with is last week, we're like, yeah, Jesus is wonderful, my salvation is brilliant, I'm so safe. And then this week, we're like, oh, I'm such a terrible person, I've lost my salvation. And it's like, no, we need to remember the whole context, okay? So this is last week's passage that Ian preached on. It says this, therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain that is through his flesh, And since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And there's a couple of other verses as well. That was Ian's passage last week, okay? Where we've got to in the letter of Hebrews is really, he's just been, the author has been talking about who Jesus is, the great one, the one who's higher than any other, the name above all names, and the sacrifice that he's made and how he's entered into the holy places in heaven with his own blood, and it only needs to be done once for all time, and it's finished, it's completed, and now he's our great high priest who's interceding for us, and this is who he is. Okay, and last week's passage was like the appropriate way to respond to that kind of message, to that gospel. The appropriate way is therefore to draw near with confidence in Jesus, having our hearts sprinkled clean by him in full assurance of faith. That's the appropriate response to this incredible gospel. This week's passage we'll read now, and I think you'll see it's meant to be a contrast to last week's passage. That's why I read last week's as well. It's a contrast. If last week's was the appropriate way to respond to this incredible gospel, this week's is the inappropriate way to respond. Okay? Here we are. Hebrews 10, verse 26 and on. For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has outraged the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. But recall the former days when, after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay, but my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls. Okay. This letter, as we've seen through the whole lot so far, is written by someone to a group of people who are steeped in the Old Testament, right? They really get it. They know it. They memorized most of it. They really know it through and through. And so this author is able to, as we've seen, throw in sort of symbols and stories and stuff from the Old Testament just as quick references and then moves on. And the reason for that is because everyone who heard it and the author themselves were just able to sort of import all this meaning and context in a way that, let's be honest, we're not. Because we're not steeped in the Old Testament in quite the same way. This passage that we just read has three quotes from two books of the Old Testament. And again, it's important to know that as they're quoted, that the original hearers wouldn't have just taken them at face value and then moved on, but was able to import the context in which those quotes come from, the passage around it, and what the meaning of that passage was to shed light into this passage. Does that make sense? Now, none of us can do that, I don't imagine. I certainly can't. Okay, and so what we need to do is a bit of background work. We need to go back to those passages, understand what's going on in those passages, so that we can understand the Hebrews 10 passage. So we've got a bit of work to do, okay, but that's what we're going to do. What the three quotes, two of them come from Deuteronomy chapter 32, and one of them comes from Habakkuk chapter 2. And those chapters, and in fact Habakkuk as a whole, are really asking the question and meditating on the question, how does the judgment of God work? It's not something that we preach on very often, but here we are. How does the judgment of God work? And I think what we see always is that his ways are higher than ours. Okay, how does the judgment of God work then? Actually, I think what often we think of when someone says even a question like that, the judgment of God, what we might think of is a story like Sodom and Gomorrah in the old, you know, in like Genesis, where, you know, God like throwing down fire and brimstone from heaven and whatnot and sulfur and like that. God like actively doing something to people. That's the judgment of God, and pretty scary, right? And like, there are those stories in the Bible. You have to deal with that. There are those stories. Okay, but actually, the judgment of God through the Bible much more commonly happens rather than God throwing down stuff from heaven. It actually happens by God handing people over to the consequences of their sinful desires and actions. That is the active judgment of God as it is presented often through the Bible. God not withholding the consequences of people's sinful desires and actions, but rather letting them pursue sinful desires and actions to their bitter end. That means that is an active thing. God is involved, that is his active judgment, and yet at the same time it must mean that people are responsible for their decisions, actions, and even desires. And we see that in Deuteronomy chapter 32, where two of our quotes come from. Deuteronomy 32 is a song, Moses' song. Deuteronomy as a book is written just before the people go into the promised land. They've been wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years, and this new generation are about to go into the promised land, and Moses recounts the whole law to them again, and then presents them with a choice, which we'll talk more about in a minute, and then he sings this song as his sort of way of bowing out of the world, because then he dies. He sings a song, okay? And that's what Deuteronomy 32 is. And this song basically recounts the story of the Bible thus far, up to Deuteronomy 32. And his song talks about how all the nations are corrupt. Not going to hear it on the radio, all right? All the nations are corrupt, but God chose Israel from the nations as his firstborn son, that he loved Israel, cherished Israel, nurtured him like a firstborn son, but that then Israel rebelled as well because Israel was plagued with the same sin as everyone else. And so then God, through this song, is portrayed as bringing judgment on Israel. Okay? So, for example, verse 23 says this. This is as though God speaking. I will heap disasters upon them. I will spend my arrows on them. All right, so that sounds like this kind of fire and brimstone, God going to throw stuff down, I'm going to spend arrows, whatever that means, an active kind of thing, right? But actually, what we also see more subtly, even in this very chapter, is how God does that. So, for example, in verse 20, it says this. God says, I will hide my face from them, and I will see what their end will be. Yeah? I'm gonna turn away, as it were, and I'm gonna see what their end will be. I'm gonna let them pursue their desires. I'm gonna let them pursue their rebellion and sin, and we'll see where it ends up. And again in verse 29 it says, if they were wise, they would understand, they would discern their latter end. What they lack is wisdom. They're pursuing folly and foolishness and rebellion. If they were wise, they would understand, but they're not. And here we go. I'm going to let them go. I'm going to let them pursue it, and they'll live with the consequences of it. That is the active judgment of God. And our quotes from Hebrews 10, we see in verse 35 and 36 of Deuteronomy 32. So this chapter is about how does the judgment, at least part of it, is about how does the judgment of God work. And actually what we see is that he hands people over to their desires and lets them run with sin and evil and bear the consequences of that. Okay, the next one I said, the next quote in Hebrews 10 comes from Habakkuk chapter 2. And Habakkuk is an interesting book. It's one of the little fiddly minor prophets that you can't find ever. All right, I can't. Okay, and there it is. And it's an interesting one. the context in which it was written was to Judah, okay, the southern kingdom. There was Israel and Judah. They were once one. They split into two. Judah was the bottom one. And it was written in the last few decades before Babylon invaded Judah and took them into exile, okay? And Habakkuk's living as a kind of righteous guy in the context of Judah, which was full of that point, at that point, of all sorts of corruption and injustice and violence and that kind of thing. And so Habakkuk is an interesting little book, because rather than most of the prophets, which is sort of God using them as a mouthpiece to talk about what he's going to do and all that sort of stuff, Habakkuk is actually a dialogue between the prophet himself and God. He's not talking to other people. He's just having a dialogue with God. And it's all about how does God's justice work, okay? And so Habakkuk starts by looking around him in his context in Judah and going, there's so much violence and injustice and corruption. God, how can you be just and allow this to carry on? And then God answers him and he says, actually, I see all that violence and injustice. And what I'm going to do is I am raising up this nation, Babylon. Okay, they look big and scary to you. Actually, I'm behind it. I'm bringing them and they're going to invade and take them into exile and bring judgment onto Judah for their violence and injustice. And then Habakkuk goes, what? Hold on, how does that work? Babylonians are even worse. How can it be possible that you bringing more violence and injustice, how can that be justice? And then God replies again, and God says to them, well, actually, I'm going to hold the Babylonians to account for their violence and injustice. In fact, I'm going to hold all peoples and all nations to account. And so then Habakkuk basically does what I think is the most sensible thing. In chapter 3, verse 2, he says this, O Lord, I have heard the report of you and your work. O Lord, do I fear? He basically says, whoa, your ways are higher than my ways. I'm looking at this from my perspective and I don't really understand how this can be just and how this and that and the other. All I can do is quietly trust that you're much bigger than me, that you understand it, and that you are a God of perfect justice, and that you will bring true perfect justice to all things, and this is how you're going to do it. I'm a bit scared of this kind of God. That's what Habakkuk says. Okay? So, that's the background. When this Hebrews author quotes these verses, the people, the original hearers, are able to import this. Okay, cool, this is about God's judgment and how his judgment works and that his ways are way higher than ours. Okay, right, so that's the background, okay? Bear some of that in mind. Now we're going to look at Hebrews chapter 10. I realize that this is complicated. Trust me, I had to do the work. It's complicated, all right? All right, Hebrews chapter 10, back to that. So what this passage is really about in Hebrews 10 is asking the question, or answering the question, what can stop us? What can stop us as the people of God from staying faithful and true to Jesus, from following him with endurance? What can stop us? And I think the author gives us two things in basically the two halves of this passage. One is deliberate sin, and the other is the fear of the world. Okay, so we'll look at both of those. What can stop us? First bit, verses 26 to 31, is about deliberate sin. I'm just going to read verses 26 and 27 again. It says this, for if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Now, if you're a Christian in here, with a shred of integrity, then these verses, I think, should be a little bit scary. Because it says, if you go on sinning deliberately, this is what we expect. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I have deliberately sinned in my life, and so have you. All right? I have got to decisions in my life, and I'm like, I know what the right thing to do is here, and I know what the wrong thing to do is here, and I'm going to do the wrong one. That's deliberate sin. I have done that many times, and so have you. Okay? This is the right thing. This is the wrong thing. I'm going to choose the wrong path, and I know it. That's deliberate sin. Woo! then you read here, someone who deliberately sins, this is what to expect. Is that talking about me? Is that talking about you? Well, when you dig into it, when you read commentaries and whatnot, and dig into the, well, let the experts who understand all the language and whatnot that this was originally written in, these verses are speaking about someone who deliberately persists in sin in an open and intentional way that desires to show contempt for God after they have fully understood the truth of the gospel. Okay? So this is not speaking about someone who actually their deepest desires are to follow Jesus, to overcome sin, and to put sin to death. It's not speaking about someone in that position, and I'll be honest with you, that's me. That is me. I'm confident in my heart, where I am, that's me. I want to follow Jesus. There are times when I mess up, but I want to put sin to death and overcome it, okay? These verses are not speaking about someone in that position, even if you're someone who is in that position and yet you're caught up in a habit of ongoing sin, habitual sin that you cannot seem to get over. Even if you're in that position, these verses are not talking about that. However, if you are in that position of habitual sin that you cannot seem to get over, then I think you should heed the warning from these verses. We are called to take sin very, very seriously, to not accommodate it, to not let it fester, to not let it grow, to not let it snowball, because it always will, okay? But rather to be ruthless with sin. The way that you do that, most fundamentally, is to bring it into the light. When sin is hidden, it has power. When you bring it into the light, like Charlie shared with us earlier, it loses its power, okay? The way that you do that practically is you confess it to God and you confess it to a trusted brother or sister that you know who can hold you accountable and walk with you in grace and love and kindness, but you bring it into the light, okay? If you're in that position, heed the warning in these verses. But if you're in that position and you're like, I don't want this, I want to follow Jesus, I want to overcome, I want to put sin to death, these verses are not talking about you. They are talking about someone who deliberately persisting in sin in an open and intentional way that desires to show contempt for God after they have fully understood the truth of the gospel. Okay? Now remember how judgment works, as we've just been looking at, okay? What had gone before Moses' song in Deuteronomy 32, as we've said, is that Moses presented the law to the people, and then he said, you have a choice, people. Okay, now you've heard this, you've got a choice. You can choose obedience, in their context, to the law, which leads to life and to blessing. Or you can choose disobedience, which leads to judgment and leads to death. And Moses, as God's mouthpiece to the people, implores them, choose life. Don't choose death. Choose life. You've got a choice. Choose life. And I think the same idea runs behind this passage. The gospel, the blood of Jesus, the spirit of grace has been given, has been poured out, new life, new creation, new starts, resurrection life in the fullness of life has been offered as a free gift in Jesus. Choose life. Receive Jesus and remain in Jesus. Choose him today and every day. Choose him. Don't choose death as a way of life. Choose life. That's what this passage is talking about. If you don't, this passage says, if you don't, if you trample the Son of God underfoot instead, you are choosing judgment and death. Remember how judgment works. God's active judgment on people is to hand them over to their own sinful desires, to let it run amok and see where it leads. And where does it lead? Sin always, always leads to corruption, dehumanization, cruelty, misery, and death. Just watch the news later. Okay? That is where sin leads when it is left to run its path. So choose life. Choose life. Receive Jesus and remain in him. And these verses and this passage, I think, should cause us to ask the question, so does this mean that when we are once saved, we are always saved? Right? You might have heard that phrase being used. Once saved, always saved. Yeah? I can't lose my salvation. No one can lose their salvation. Once we're saved, we're always saved. As a quote, that phrase doesn't appear in the Bible. It is based on verses in the New Testament that seem to affirm it, okay? Our hope in our salvation is not on our ability to be faithful to God, but rather is on Jesus's perfect faithfulness and perfect completed work on our behalf given to us as a free gift. I believe that. And I'm very grateful for it. Okay? My hope is not in my ability to remain faithful to him, but is rather in Jesus's perfect faithfulness on my behalf and his perfectly finished work. When I stand before God on judgment day, one day before his holy throne that Bernice read about earlier, we're all going to do that, brothers and sisters. Consider that regularly. When I stand there, all I'm going to be able to do, and I'm in a way kind of looking forward to it, is point to Jesus and say, I've got nothing, he's my hope. That's it. So, I believe that. However, believing that mustn't mean that we essentially cross out verses like these from the New Testament and pretend that they're not there. See, these verses seem to be speaking about somebody who has truly, truly understood the gospel to the point where it has made an impact upon their life and they have been part of the community of the people of God and then have chosen to completely reject it and him and go after a pattern of deliberate sin and contempt for God. Now, one of the ways that we might explain it, we might even be thinking of people in that, who, you know, we could say is that in that situation. One of the ways we might explain it, you might have heard people explain it, it's like, well, maybe they weren't a Christian in the first place. Well, the truth is, I don't know. And you don't know. We can only be sure on our own hearts, really, before God. What I do know is that there is mystery before God, and we should soberly receive the full counsel of the Lord in his word, not just pick and choose bits that are easy and back up our point of view. We mustn't just choose the nice bits of scripture to sit under, okay? This here, these verses, are a stark and sobering warning to the people of God. I don't think they can be read in any other way. All right, that's the first bit. Bit heavy, this one, isn't it? It's not me, it's just what it says. All right, that's the first bit. The second bit, fear of the world. Fear that causes someone to shrink back from following Jesus. This letter was written to some real people, you know? So a real, probably quite small community who had decided that they were going to follow Jesus. And because they had done that, this small community had faced some real hardship because of their allegiance to Jesus. They had been publicly mocked, physically abused, some of them put in prison. They'd had their homes and their possessions ransacked, removed because of their allegiance to Jesus. And we read that in these pretty extreme circumstances, they did not shrink back in fear. They stood by one another. They took care of those in prison for their allegiance to Jesus. And in doing so, exposed themselves to the same risks of danger and whatnot. And even, it says, they joyfully accepted that as part of following Jesus. Not begrudgingly, not moaningly. They joyfully accepted that kind of deal as a part of following Jesus. And so the author's like, you've already been through this. Don't shrink back now. It's pretty challenging, right? They didn't shrink back. Verse 36 says, For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. That wasn't just true for them. That is true for us. We have need of endurance. Okay? So what might make us shrink back? Maybe persecution. All right. It is unlikely that in our lifetimes in this country there will be this kind of persecution, that will be chucked into prison and beaten up and whatnot for faith in Jesus. It's unlikely. But there is growing soft forms of persecution already in our culture and our context, and I'm pretty sure that's only going to go one way, to be honest. All right, so you already know people or heard of people whose jobs are on the line, maybe have lost jobs, simply for believing a different something, all right, that doesn't fit with the mainstream anymore. It might not even be like actively preaching it or anything, but just you can just believe something now and your job could be on the line. If that happens to you, what are you going to do? It will happen to people in this room in the next 5 years, 10 years. What are you going to do? Will we shrink back or will we hold on? Will we support one another like these people did? All right? So we can just sort of swim along in life, can't we? So often. All right? We've got to dig deep now while it's easy so that we can stand strong then when it's hard. All right? What else could make us shrink back? The cares of life, the allures of middle-class comfort. All right, if it's a choice between a nice, comfortable life and actually obedience to Jesus on some particular decision, maybe he calls you to move somewhere else, oh, that would be hard. What are you going to do? Will you shrink back? What about ongoing suffering and the unanswered questions that are included in ongoing suffering? God, why? You know, these are real things, right? Why? Why did that have to happen? Why is it happening to me? Why haven't you healed? Why, God? There's a choice in that moment to give up, to go, oh, maybe he's not who he says he is. Or to live with those unanswered questions in ongoing suffering, which is not easy, no one's saying it is, but to say, I am going to remain faithful no matter what. I just want to take a moment and we will collectively honour Simon and Becky Brown right now. They've been through so much in the last 7 years. And like, I get to regularly pray with Simon, who is in constant real pain right now, on top of so much other stuff. And he is a faithful giant. And I love him for it. What an elder we have. You know, what an example we have of this. Okay, real stuff constantly. And yet, I'm not making light of it. It's really, really, really hard. I want it to end. Please, Jesus. But he's like, I'm going to stay. I'm going to trust him. I'm going to stay firm. Right? That's the way to do it. We have people in our midst doing that, and they're not the only ones. Okay. So what can stop us? That's what this passage is about. What could cause us to fall away? Deliberate sin, fear of the world. The solution to both, I believe, is the fear of the Lord. Who is the Lord? This brings us back to where we started. I think that we see in this passage that there are deeper depths and more complexity to the Lord than perhaps we often think. So who is the Lord? Well, we saw in our opening verses of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 1, that the ultimate revelation of the Lord is Jesus. All right, Hebrews 1 verse 3. Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. If you want to know what God is like, you look at Jesus. There is no God out there who is not like Jesus. However, I think against the backdrop of Old Testament passages like those we've looked at today, and against stark warnings like we see in Hebrews chapter 10, I think we must conclude that Jesus is more complex and deep than perhaps we think of in our day-to-day lives. But at the same time, I think that that means the gospel is more profound than we dare to believe. What we've seen in this book of Hebrews, what the author is trying to present week on week as we've preached through it, is sort of two things. The holiness of God. Right? The otherness, the set apartness, the there is no one like him-ness of God, and the grace of God. Okay? And these two things are not in tension with each other in God. It's not like he's like really holy some days and then really gracious other days. Right? It's not like he's split into like the holy, scary God of the Old Testament and then a bit nicer Jesus in the New Testament. Okay, what this author is trying to present is these two things, the holiness of God and the grace of God, and that when we understand them together, actually, they magnify each other. All right, when we view the holiness of God through the lens of the grace of God, his holiness becomes something not to fear and cower away from, but something incredibly beautiful, because the invite is to come and be holy as I am holy. And then when we view his grace through the lens of his holiness, his grace is that much more precious and amazing because of who it comes from. And I think problems arise when we overemphasize one of these two things to the detriment of the other. So grace on its own, with no reference to the holiness of God, could lead to sort of flippancy, okay, and over-familiarity in our walk with God. It doesn't really matter. There's grace for that. Just a little white lie, just another couple of drinks. Doesn't really matter. Flippancy. Reference to of just focusing on his holiness without understanding his grace actually can lead to an inappropriate fear, a distance. Like, I can't draw near him. He doesn't want to know me. How could he possibly? But bringing these two together magnify each other and I think produce the fear of the Lord in the most wonderful and appropriate way. Jesus, our friend, our Saviour, our Deliverer, is the Holy One of Israel in the Old Testament. Jesus is that one. Jesus is the Holy One of Israel who's seated on a throne that even angels cover their faces with their wings. As he hangs on the cross, he is that one. The Holy One of Israel who raises up nations to bring judgment on other nations and then holds all of them to account. As we saw in Habakkuk, Jesus is that one. The one who brings his active judgment upon people even today. This is in Romans chapter 1 as well. This is not just an old thing. The one who brings his active judgment on people by allowing them to pursue their sinful desires to their bitter end, as we see in Deuteronomy, Jesus is that one. The one of glory and majesty, the one of fury and fire. Jesus is the Holy One of Israel, the Ancient of Days, the righteous judge of all the earth. Jesus is that one as he gives his life for ours, as he hangs with death-defeating, resurrection life-bringing love and mercy and grace pouring out of him from the cross. This act, this act of infinite humility and mercy and grace is the ultimate revelation of the Holy One of Israel. If you want to know what God is like, you look at Jesus on the cross. But as we read the Old Testament and we encounter scary God of the Old Testament, we must read it through the lens of the cross, because that is where this God was always heading. But also, as we look at the cross, we mustn't forget who's hanging there. The Holy One of Israel, the righteous judge of all the earth. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. That's what Paul is led to declare in Romans chapter 11. Our call, brothers and sisters, is to allegiance to this king. This king whose crown was first made out of thorns and whose throne was first shaped as a cross. Allegiance to this king. What can stop you? What could stop us from following him to the bitter end? Sin, fear, the cares of this life? Let me encourage you with the author to the Hebrews. Draw near to him. Receive him with reverence. receive him and remain in him every single day. But draw near. Give your allegiance to this king. Don't hold anything back. Don't choose death as a way of life. Surrender to him. Don't shrink back. Like Peter, who got out of the boat, right? Don't look to the waters and drown. Keep your eyes fixed on his and keep walking towards him, no matter how the storm rages around you. There is great reward for those who do this. Jesus is more complex than we often think. But that means that the gospel is far more profound than we dare believe. So I want us to respond for a few minutes. And actually, the way that I want us to do that is something that we don't often do at all. But sometimes I think the most appropriate thing to do is just humble silence before him. And I want to encourage you, as we are quiet together, to consider Jesus. Consider the Lord in all his holiness and grace, in all his depth and complexity, in all his majesty and mercy. Consider him. Consider your life before him. Consider Habakkuk's response to him. And let's just do that for a few minutes together.